The next case for the Southern Panel is DeMarinville versus Employers Insurance Company of Nevada and Cannon Cochran Management Services in the City of Reno, case number 72737. Mr. Beavers, you ready to go?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Evan Beavers and I serve as Nevada Attorney for Injured Workers. And I'm here this morning on behalf of Laura DeMarinville, your appellant. The appellant seeks to establish three things in this appeal. First of all, that her husband, a retired Reno Police Detective Daniel DeMarinville, died of occupational heart disease. Secondly, that as a surviving spouse, Laura DeMarinville is entitled to survivor benefits. And lastly, that those benefits must be based upon the earnings that Daniel DeMarinville was earning at the time of his disability, which is the date of his death. The appeals officer, administrative law judge, who first heard this case and considered the evidence, came to the conclusion that Daniel DeMarinville did indeed die of occupational heart disease, and the district judge, upon review, found substantial evidence to support that conclusion. The appeals officer also came to the conclusion that Laura DeMarinville is entitled to compensation benefits as the survivor, and that those compensation benefits must be based upon the earnings that her deceased husband was earning at the date he died. The district court, though, upon review, undertook that analysis on average monthly wage and came to the conclusion that because the decedent wasn't earning a wage from the city of Reno at the time he deceased, that the amount of average monthly wage was zero, compensation to the widow must be zero. It's that last point that is the basis of her appeal. If I may provide a bit of a history on the litigation leading to this appeal. According to the certified death certificate recorded in the records of Washoe County, Daniel DeMarinville died of cardiac arrest as a consequence of atherosclerotic heart disease on August 5, 2012. The appeals officer was presented with a very large volume of medical evidence in this case, and also the opinions of a number of medical experts. The appeals officer weighed one of those opinions over the others. Dr. Ruggieroli, a cardiologist from here in Las Vegas, was the only physician who saw in those medical records the results of a cardiac enzyme test shortly before Mr. DeMarinville died of heart failure. And the appeals officer had the records of that troponin testing before her during the hearing. Dr. Ruggieroli was therefore, may have been the only doctor to rely on the complete medical record informing his opinion. Dr. Ruggieroli determined that Daniel DeMarinville died of heart disease, and the appeals officer relied on that opinion.
And the appeals officer was within their right to credit that testimony, correct?
Most certainly, Your Honor.
And that was the only doctor that had the cardiac information.
It's difficult to tell what information the other doctors had because there's not a complete record of what they looked at,
sure,
informing their opinion. But the complete record of what Ruggieroli looked at is indeed in the record.
Mm-hmm.
Upon review, the district court found substantial evidence to affirm the appeals officer's decision as to causation of death. The appeals officer also found that Laura DeMarinville, as a surviving spouse, was entitled to compensation in the form of death benefits. The appeals officer placed that liability with the city of Reno, the employer, during the entire term of Daniel DeMarinville's career in law enforcement. The district court affirmed the appeals officer's determination placing the liability with the city of Reno. The appellant takes no position as to this contest between the city of Reno or Employers Insurance Company of Nevada, and I informally refer to him as ICON from time to time. However, the appellant does take a position in regards to the district court's treatment of the survivor's benefits. That determination deserves this court's appeal, and that determination deserves this court's reversal.
District Court Judge Wilson, in his order, talks about the appeals officer failing to consider NAC 616C.435 sub 9, that the wages must be calculated from the monthly wage earned in the employment that caused the occupational disease, and came up with obviously a time of death is zero then. What do you make of the fact that Judge Wilson talks about the appeals officer's failure to consider that statute?
I don't think it's correct to say that she did not consider it, because it was in the briefing. The appeals officer not only heard, took an evidentiary hearing in this matter, she also asked for supplemental briefing. And in that supplemental briefing, these regulations were addressed. What the appeals officer did is follow a different regulation, which just is a few sections down, that says the earnings of an injured employee on the date on which the accident occurs or the date of which the injured employee was no longer able to work as a result of contracting an occupational disease will be used to calculate the average monthly wage. In other words, Justice Sorbo.
What is the regulation for that?
That's NAC 616C.441. So my argument is the appeals officer used a regulation that's particular to occupational disease, whereas the district court did not.
The district court used one that's particular to industrial accident, which by definition happens within the employment period. Is that correct?
I think that's true, and I think the district court, if I may read directly from the court's decision, at page 5 of the court's decision under the heading, the amount of benefits due, the court writes, in this case, the appeals officer ruled the death benefits should be based on the claimant's wages at the time of his death, even though his employment at that time had nothing to do with the occupational disease. And that's at the start of the court's analysis. And I think that indicates that the court may have been misdirected from the start.
And that's on Judge Wilson's page 5, you said?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Because this court has held in the Manuel decision that this determination of trying to tie the occupational disease to some date and time during the employment or some cause during employment, that's not the law in Nevada. According to the Manuel v. Clark decision in 2007, this court determined that heart disease in a considering the same statute, NRS 617-457, the court determined that heart disease was occupational whenever contracted. An employee is entitled to benefits not from the contraction of the disease, but from compensation. But compensation flows instead from the disablement resulting from the disease. In other words, Daniel Deaton Randall was entitled to death benefit or entitled to occupational disease benefits for heart disease because of his relationship with this employer. It's a relationship between the employer and the employee that determines whether or not the employer is going to be liable. There is no identifiable contraction date, nor need there be. But that seems to be where the district court went in trying to pin down some date on which to find average monthly wage.
Doesn't Howard actually support your position? I mean, Howard's been read to support respondent's position. I think Wilson took a look at that. But Howard said he gets no benefits, no wage replacement, because he didn't have a wage at the time the injury.
Justice Stiglitz, I think Howard does get misinterpreted from time to time. Because in Howard, this court did say that particular firefighter doesn't get temporary total disability benefits because that firefighter wasn't earning a wage. And the same thing can be said of Daniel D. Moranville. He was a retired would have been a beneficiary under 457. That the difference is Daniel D. Moranville was earning a wage at the date of his disability, and he's entitled to that wage. And that's consistent with an earlier case, clear back in 1998, when this court first considered NRS 617-457 in the Gallagher case. And the statute had only been on the books since 1991. This court did an exhaustive legislative history and came to the determination that while police officers and firefighters were entitled to the benefits under this statute after retirement, it's a lifetime benefit. And I would argue that it remained a lifetime benefit until 2015. That's when the legislature, for the first time, tried to put some parameters around this liability to municipalities and finally said, as to lifetime benefits, these beneficiaries, police officers and firefighters, they'll get lifetime medical benefits, but their compensation benefits are cut off. And so I would argue...
Well, wouldn't it be fair that the legislature was interpreting Howard to direct that and they just codified it?
If they did, they did an unartful job of it, Judge, because it doesn't address that in the statute, and it's not retroactive in its application. Mm-hmm. And if what they were trying to do was go back to Howard, which at that point was 10 years old, they could have made it retroactive back to that date. This statute, 6.7...
Well, it wouldn't have been necessary for them to do that if they thought Howard covered that issue.
Well, an argument I would make against interpreting...
Is there anything in the legislative history in 2015 that suggests one way or the other whether how the legislature viewed Howard's decision in this area?
I'm not aware of any reference to Howard in the 2015 amendment, Judge.
Okay.
But I can point out that 617-457 was amended in 2009 without making any effort to want to corral this compensation, lifetime compensation liability. It was amended again in 2011, and that was what was in effect when Daniel D. Moranville deceased and his wife made her claim. It was amended again in 2013 without imposing this limitation that we speak of now. Finally, in 2015, the legislature made the statement in subsection 14 of the existing statute that beneficiaries get lifetime medical benefits, but no other compensation benefits. So the legislature had many opportunities between the time of Howard and the time it finally in 2015 amended the statute and didn't take those opportunities. I would argue that's an indication they didn't intend to make those amendments.
So under your theory of the case, it wouldn't matter if the decedent in this case had been employed by a security firm or had been the president of MGM making $4.5 million a year. I'm throwing that out.
No, I understand.
So would we use that significant salary that I just mentioned? I don't know what Jim Murren makes, but
you would.
Hypothetically. So we would use that salary?
You would under the current law.
What would be the rationale and the opinion to support such a conclusion?
Because it goes the other way also, Justice Hardesty. Had a police officer retired entitled prior to this 2015 amendment, been entitled to benefits, it goes to work, and I don't mean to degrade the Walmart greeter, but there's a job that's probably $8 an hour. Had he had a massive heart attack and he died and he had once served a long enough period of time that he was qualified for benefits under 617-457, if that's the wage that the statute seeks to compensate the widow for, that would be the wage on which to calculate average monthly wage. It could go either way.
But if he's retired at the time of his death, he gets nothing?
My point is prior to that 2015 amendment. Now,
yes, I'm talking about prior to 2015.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I must misunderstand your question.
If DeMarinville had been unemployed at the time of his death, prior to 2015, under this decision that you're advocating, he would get nothing.
There would be no wage on which to calculate average monthly wage, and that statutorily is the way to get to the widow's compensation. Mm-hmm. You're right, Your Honor.
Okay.
May I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
But Mr. Beavers, I mean, the legislature contemplated certainly the MGM, the officer done good and become president of MGM because there's a wage cap.
Exactly.
They don't get $4 million if that's their yearly income. I think in this case, DeMarinville was capped at about $5,600, and his widow was also capped per statute at 66 and two-thirds. Is that correct?
There's two reductions in the income. She'll never receive the wages that he brought home the day before he died.
Right.
Because by statute, it's calculated, as most workers' compensation disability benefits are, on 66 and two-thirds of whatever that average monthly wage, and then that amount is capped. That's how the appeals officer got it down to $3,400. But I don't see any interpretation of the law which would make it zero unless you go through this analysis. You're trying to tie the disease or the contraction of the disease to some hypothetical date. This woman did not lose some hypothetical wage. She lost the wage resulting from her husband's death, and there's nothing in the written word of our state legislature or this court's previous decisions interpreting that written word which would say that the benefit is zero. That simply results in an absurd result. That deserves reconsideration by this court. That's an absurd result. I reserve the remainder of my time until after.
Okay, Mr. Beavers. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Rowe, how are you? How do you folks intend to divide up your time?
I was going to ask that question, Your Honor. What Mark and I agreed to do was to split it right down the middle, 15 minutes down the middle, so we'd each have 7.5 minutes.
Seems only fair.
Okay. May it please the Court, Timothy Rowe on behalf of City of Reno and its third-party administrator, Cannon Cochran Management Services, Inc. As Mr. Beavers indicated, there's really three issues in dispute here. I want to start with what I think is really the simplest issue, and that is the question of whether or not Mr. DeMarinville died of heart disease. It is the city's position that conclusion by the appeals officer is not supported by substantial evidence, and in the simplest terms, I would assert it this way. There were four cardiologists who reviewed this case. Three of those cardiologists, including the attending cardiologist at the time of Mr. DeMarinville's death, concluded there was insufficient evidence to determine what the cause of death was because there was no autopsy. Now, admittedly, Dr. Ruggeroli concluded otherwise, but it is our position because there was no autopsy done, there is really no way to make that conclusion. The second issue I want to address is whether Ms. DeMarinville is entitled to death benefits. As we indicated in our brief, it's our position that the district court correctly decided this issue, and that is because the statutory method of calculating average monthly wage upon which the death benefit would be calculated precludes award of death benefits because Mr. DeMarinville was not earning any wage from the employment that presumptively caused his heart disease at the time of death. We think the Howard decision supports that rationale. It leads to that conclusion. We believe that conclusion was ultimately adopted by the legislature in 2015 when it amended 617-457, adding subsection 14. If you consider that along with the regulation, NAC 616C-435, subsection 9, that requires earnings used to calculate the average monthly wage or the earnings from the employment in which the injury occurs. When you consider that regulation, it's clear we think that the measurement of the wage that applies here would be zero. I want to point out NRS 617.015, which indicates that the industrial injury statutes and regulations apply to occupational disease cases unless otherwise stated. So the fact that the regulation refers to industrial injuries, I don't think negates its impact in this case because of that statute. The third issue I want to address is which insurer is responsible for benefits here, assuming benefits are owed. Our position is that liability must fall on the insurer covering the employment that presumptively caused Mr. DeMarinville's heart disease. Here, liability must fall on Employers Insurance Company of Nevada because it was the only insurer that covered the employment which presumptively caused Mr. DeMarinville's heart disease. Case law establishes that where you have a single employer, which is the case here, the City of Reno was his employer throughout his period of employment, but successive insurers, and in this case there were successive insurers, our position is that the last injurious exposure rule places liability on the last insurer covering the risk during the most recent exposure bearing a causal relationship to the disability. The case in our brief at pages 28, 29, and 30, we cited the cases that established that principle, primarily the Fockhauser case from Washington. The only employment here bearing a causal relationship to Mr. DeMarinville's heart disease was his employment as a police officer from 1969 to 1990. The only insurer during that time period was ICON. And so our position here is that liability, if there is any, must fall on ICON because it was the insurer insuring the risk that caused the actual occupational disease in this case. If there are questions, I would be happy to take whatever questions you have.
Since we deal with that third issue, I wonder if you'd comment on the city's position as to why they're not, I mean, ICON's position as to why they're not liable, and specifically the last injurious employer rule and its application here.
Yeah, I think
like
the argument...
your position on that before you sit down.
I think the position that ICON is articulating is essentially the Daniels case, which was successive employers, not successive insurers. And this case differs from Daniels because it is a successive insurer case, not a successive but employer
Larson
case.
Larson seems to identify a number of cases that equate the two.
Well, I think the last injurious exposure rule applies in either scenario, where you have successive employers or successive insurers. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, we have only successive insurers, and that last insurer, the city, is a self-insured entity, never covered the risk of the employment that caused, or theoretically caused, the occupational disease here, which was the employment from 69 to 90. City didn't become self-insured until 2002, 12 years later. So they're not the entity that ever insured that risk. So because they're not the entity that insured the risk, I don't think liability can fall on the city. It has to go back to ICON because they're the only one with connection to the occupation that actually caused the disease.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mark Zerdick on behalf of Employers Insurance Company of Nevada. With respect to the monthly benefit issue, it is quite telling that the appeals officer failed to discuss at all the controlling regulation in this case, which is NAC 616C435, particularly subsection 9. And as Mr. Rowe stated, that is controlling in this case, even though it's an occupational disease case, because NRS 617.015, which governs occupational diseases, tells us that we have to look to the regulations under the accident provisions of 616A through D, the statutes and regulations, in order to determine the benefits and liabilities for occupational disease cases. They just didn't duplicate them all. So we go to the accident provisions to determine that. And the fact that the appeals officer relied on NAC 616C441 is not dispositive here. That statute says the earnings of an injured employee on the date on which an accident occurs or the date on which the injured employee is no longer able to work as a result of contracting an occupational disease will be used to calculate the average monthly wage. That begs the question of what are earnings. And that is answered by NAC 616C435, subsection 9, which says, as used in this section, quote, earnings, close quote, means earnings received from the employment in which the injury occurs. Since we're talking about disease, you could substitute injury for the disease or disablement.
But you can't really substitute. Disease is different than an industrial injury is different than an occupational disease, which contemplates that could rear its head many years after a person is out of employment. That is different than having a fire truck roll over your foot in the middle of fighting a fire or getting burned or getting shot on the job. Getting either cancer or heart disease that the statute has identified is, in this case, conclusively related to the employment. How can you treat those the same? Because your reading would, by definition, suggest that this wage replacement just did not apply to retired people. And forget about retired people. It could just be people that separated but didn't retire. Of course you're covered during employment. This is after employment. So how do we reconcile that?
The regulation does discuss and talk about accidents, but it also is clearly applicable to an occupational disease case. And the statutes and And case law, I'll get to in just a second, says that liability and a valid claim does not occur, can't arise until you have an occupational disease and disability. So at that point, that's when the benefits come into play. And at that point, if you look at 441 and 435, both subsection 1, which says you use 12 weeks prior, and subsection 8, which says the period used to calculate the average monthly wage must consist of consecutive days ending on the date on which the accident or disease occurred or the last day of payroll preceding the accident or disease. And then it defines what earnings are. If you don't use 435, you have no definition of what earnings are to apply to the disease case. So I'd submit that you have to do that in order to get there. But the appeals officer in this case didn't even address it. She didn't make the argument you're making. She ignored it completely. And I would submit that ignoring that constitutes an arbitrary and capricious determination.
Why isn't 441 a better fit here than 435?
Because 441 leaves the definition of earnings up in the air. It says earnings, and the only place we have a definition of earnings is in 435 subsection 9.
Well, maybe in the NAC, but in the NRS we have definitions of how to calculate average monthly wage and those type of things.
Actually, Your Honor, I think the NRS says that the administrator shall prepare regulations to make that determination. And if I have a moment, I can probably find that site.
So NAC 616C441, which is titled Earnings Used to Calculate Average Monthly Wage, states earnings of an injured employee on the date on which an accident occurs or the date on which an injured employee is no longer able to work as a result of contracting an occupational disease will be used to calculate the average monthly wage.
Correct.
So...
but we don't have a definition of earnings except in 435. And that's a term of art because in 435, it doesn't say whatever you're making. It says received from the employment relating to the disease or accident.
Accident, mm-hmm. Not disease.
Yeah. Okay. It's the only place you have a definition.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another view here. Maybe the regulator simply failed to enact a regulation that addresses this point, so the regulations are silent. If that's the conclusion that the panel reached, what would we look to for guidance in determining earnings?
Well, actually, I'd push back a little on that. I think they did.
Well, let's assume that we disagree with your point, and we believe that the regulations are silent, or perhaps even in conflict, but let's just say they're silent on how earnings are determined. What alternative sources would the court look at to address that?
Could look at two. The Howard case, which says if you're not earning any income at the time, and that he wasn't employed at all, he was retired in that, right, in that situation, but you're not entitled to income replacement, which is basically what we're talking about here. And also the 2015 legislative changes, which, as Your Honor mentioned, could be read as codifying Howard, but it can also be read as codifying 616 NAC 616C435 paragraph 9. Subparagraph 9, because you get the same effect and the same result.
How does Howard support your position that wage is not, that he's not working, so he's not entitled to wage replacement? That seems non-controversial. But where do you extrapolate that to not working for the city, therefore not entitled to wage replacement?
Well,
how do we add that?
It's, I would submit a logical conclusion from that. He's not earning firefighter wages, so he doesn't make, or he's not entitled to temporary total disability. And so now,
Howard had just said he's retired, so
yes,
it doesn't
did.
Matter. But it didn't say that. It said he's not working, and therefore he's not entitled to the wage replacement.
Well, yeah, it said both. He was retired, he wasn't working.
Well,
but I'm not, I think I misunderstood you. It's, They said he wasn't earning a wage, therefore he doesn't get wage replacement.
Right. They didn't say he's getting retirement benefits, therefore he doesn't get
wage
replacement. They said he's not earning a wage, therefore he doesn't get wage replacement.
Correct.
Not he's not earning a wage from the city.
Correct.
Or not he's retired, so he doesn't get it. Right? It just said he's not earning a wage, so he doesn't get wage replacement. Right?
Yes.
DeMarinville was earning a wage. Isn't that correct?
He was. Totally unrelated to the city.
Where does it say it has to be related?
435.
And not 441. It says at the time of the disability.
You read them both together because you got to interpret earnings somewhere. The court needs to look somewhere for a definition of earnings. Could earnings then be income he gets from stock dividends?
Well,
mutual fund? I don't know, but I think you should actually look to something in the law related to this that gives a definition of earnings.
Well, average monthly wage encompasses earnings plus concurrent employment. So certainly there's contemplation that you could have a wage and have additional income, correct?
That's true. But that's not inconsistent with paragraph 9 of 435. I think I'm over my time.
You are. Would you like to wrap up, Mr. Sertic?
Yes.
Is there any final comment?
Your Honor, as to the issue of which employer is liable, the city's contention, in an effort to get around Daniels, is that you have to look back to when there was this first some sort of exposure to heart disease, so the employment when he was with the city. That's completely inconsistent with Daniels and inconsistent with the Manuel case. There is no exposure in this situation. They just get a presumption after 5 years that if they get heart disease, they're entitled to the benefits if and when they ever become disabled. Manuel, the firefighter, had a congenital heart disease. He brought it to his job. He didn't get it while he was there. He already had it. And so this idea of this exposure issue is really a red herring. And if the city's correct, then the Daniels case is wrong.
I would submit. Thank you, Mr. Sertic. Mr. Beavers, you have a minute 8.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. If I may answer a question that was raised by Justice Stiglitz, you were seeking statutory authority for tying these regulations together. I go back to NAC 616C.441. Again, it says, earnings of an injured employee on the date on which the injured employee is no longer able to work as a result of contracting an occupational disease will be used to calculate the average monthly wage. And the statute that defines average monthly wage is at Nevada Revised Statute 616A.065. Average monthly wage means the wage actually received. So in this case, the wage the decedent was actually receiving was the wage he was receiving the day before he passed away from occupational heart disease. And that's the check that the widow is missing, and that's the wage on which compensation ought to be calculated. And I don't think we would be having this argument if Daniel D. Moranville had died in 2016 as opposed to 2015. I think that 2015 amendment was a declaration. It's not a clarification of the law that the legislature intended to clarify or adopt something that this court decided 10 years earlier in the Howard decision. That was a change in the law. A new recruit coming out of peace officer service training now would enter the police force knowing fully well that they're entitled to lifetime medical benefits, but not lifetime compensation benefits. When Dan D. Moranville went to work with the city of Reno in 1969, this was a brand new statute that entitled him to lifetime compensation benefits. During the 70s, he patrolled the streets of Reno. During the 80s, he worked his way up to a detective. When he retired in 1990, he was entitled to lifetime benefits. When he deceased in 2012, he was entitled to lifetime benefits. His widow is entitled to compensation based upon those benefits at the time he died. And there's no way we can get back to zero for the benefit due his widow under this case. Justice Hardesty.
I have a question for all three counsel. It's a bit unusual. but it comes up occasionally, and I think it's applicable here. In light of the 2015 amendment, sometimes the court debates whether it's appropriate to resolve the case by an order or by an opinion. I'd like to ask counsel in this case whether what your view is, whether this case should be resolved by an order or an opinion.
The distinction being an order would remand it back, an opinion would bring
The distinction is the precedential value associated with the opinion.
The reason why the case has precedential value is Daniel D. Moranville can't be the only police officer who, after he separated from employment, went out and continued to earn wages. Obviously, the firefighter in Howard didn't. He went home and he was enjoying his PERS benefits. But someone who develops the skill, the talent, and the credentials of a career police officer can make a wage after they retire. They can collect their PERS benefits and they can go out. I have no idea, Justice Hardesty, how big this pool is, but I have to believe that until the law was changed in 2015, there were a number of retired firefighters, arson investigators, and firefighters that might fall into this. And that's the precedential value of the case.
Mr. Rowe?
Thank you, Your Honor. I actually agree with Mr. Beavers. I think there is a pool of police officers and firefighters out there that's fairly extensive where this precise issue could come up. Mm-hmm. I know firefighters frequently retire early and go on to other employments. I think police officers do that occasionally as well. So I would prefer an opinion because I do think this issue can come up.
And a lot of government employers would be concerned about which way that issue goes.
I agree.
Okay. And Mr. Serta?
I concur.
Okay. Thank you all very much for